Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians and entrepreneurs that are shaping the face of the healthcare revolution in the UK and beyond. As always, I want to say a big thank you to the team at UK Health Radio for the show, for the platform, and welcome if you're listening live. Also welcome if you're watching on YouTube on our channel or if you're listening on any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Stitcher, Deezer, we're on all of them. We're up on all of them. And the numbers are going up and up. So we're getting more and more people listening, which is wonderful. So on to today's show. Today's show, we've got two cracking guests today, real leaders in the health tech space from slightly different angles. So I think it's going to be a very, very interesting discussion. So we have Sarah Nelson, who's the program director for digitalhealth.london, which is also referred to as the NHS Digital Accelerator, colloquially. And PocDoc itself was on that as, a couple of years ago, and it was fantastic and transformative for us. Some people refer to it as the premier NHS Digital Accelerator. It's a hard fought title along with the National Innovation Accelerator. And I think we can get into some details with Sarah about the real sort of the reason why an accelerator is helpful and beneficial, not just obviously to the companies that are on it, but also to the actual system itself. Right. That's the as sort of kind hearted as the NHS is, there's always an angle that they want to benefit from it. And I think that's really interesting for that. And then second, we have Marcel Gehring, who is the CEO and founder of Cited, which combines AI, pathology and digital pathways to diagnose cancer more quickly, specifically esophageal cancer, I believe is their main current starting point. So, Marcel, Sarah, welcome to the show. How are you both?
Hello, Steve. Thank you. Yes, very well. Thank you.
Good. Marcel?
Hi, Steve. Great to be here again.
Good. Yeah. And now, the last time, very keen listeners will have potentially noticed that I got Marcel's name wrong. So I'm not going to do that this time. I'm going to get it right. The whole show. I even wrote it in capitals on my pad. So one of the benefits of having two guests on the show is that you can create more of a discursive type of atmosphere, which is good for you, everyone listening. So I think where I'd like to start, and we talked about this just before we went live, to you both, I'll come to Sarah first, which is, what is the value? Digital health is thrown around, the term's been thrown around for a really long time now. You can kind of pick a point where you think it kind of started, but what, call it 15 years ago? I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, depends. But what is the value, do you think, to patients and the system of what we talk about as digital healthcare, which is a super broad term, right? I mean, because like, it's kind of all digital now, you know, in one way or another. But why don't we kind of start with you, Sarah, and then we can come to Marcel, because obviously as an entrepreneur, he'll have a different view, or at least I hope so, because otherwise it might be quite a short show.
Thank you. It's certainly, digital health has influenced my career quite drastically. I've been an NHS nurse for over 30 years now. And so when I first started nursing, there wasn't digital technology in the way there is today at all.
There was nothing.
No, there was technology obviously in the intensive care units, but I had nothing at all within the ward environment in which I worked or in how I learnt my trade in my nursing training at all. Okay. So the first time I remember technology actually affecting me was when I was in a coronary care unit and a drug company brought in this computer and put it on the side of the of the ward and sort of were like, that's for you to use and that's going to help you with looking after your patient. And it was a real culture shock to us at the time to go, well, how's that going to help us with our patient? And actually, I want to keep my patient alive. If I press a button, is that actually going to have an impact on what happens. And so that real baseline misunderstanding that I had as to what it was going to do and how it was going to change things, I couldn't have contemplated where we are today for a start. But certainly at that stage, it was a real, it was a scary thing for me. And I do often think back to that time and think, actually, in the role we're in today, and a role ensuring that the innovations that we bring in are for a reason, that they actually do benefit patients and staff, and they really have a positive impact on the NHS. That's why I've sort of ended up in the role I'm in now as a nurse, but working as program director, covering a couple of programs that really bring innovation and innovators into the NHS, but also supporting NHS staff to actually be able to bring things in a way that is the most robust, if you like.
For the system to actually make it, okay.
So from the point of view of getting here, absolutely, it's been a long journey. I think in my experience, the journey has been quite, it's got a lot quicker over the last few years. When I first joined around about sort of 7-8 years ago, an IT team as a clinician, working with the IT team to make them realise what was happening, I realised that this was going to be a long journey and was probably going to be to the end of my career. Right. But over the last 5 to 7 years, there has been such a change, both in uptake of clinicians and staff working within the hospitals and within the rest of the NHS system, but also those who are innovating are at a different stage compared to where we were so many years ago. As for the benefits, sorry, I shall go back to the question.
That's okay. Don't worry. You can answer it however you like, you know, whichever way you want to go.
I think value has to be brought in from a very early stage. We need to know why it is that we're doing this, and it has to be related to patients or to staff, and there's a lot more workforce tools now than there ever were. And the value is seen when a relationship has been formed between an innovator and a organization to answer a problem that they have at that point. And once we've actually answered what the problem is and the innovation has been shown to be robust and developed and iterated, if you like, and there's a lot of conversation now about being co-produced and sort of together. If that's done from an early stage, then we are seeing impacts on patient outcomes. We are seeing impacts when it comes to uptake. Some of our companies have been able to roll out platforms literally within a weekend across the system because of things like COVID-19 happening and things like that.
I heard about that stuff. That was a big deal, I believe, back in the day where, you know, now not so much, maybe. I don't know. So anyway, I think that's super interesting. Marcel, I want to bring in you on this point because you, you know, we've known each other for a while, been on a various different, you know, talking heads, firesides, things. And the thing that I wanted to pick up on from what Sarah just said is around the benefit, having like being able to define, find a clear problem and then work that through, which is, I think, what you've done very specifically because you've built a platform, but focusing at least to begin with very specifically on one very specific type of cancer with a huge amount of friction in the diagnostic pathway. So over to you.
Thank you, Steve. I think there's one particular or one very interesting thing to start with, which is picking up from Sarah. I have been here in the UK in the NHS, and I would say, you know, in the broader healthcare world, somewhere between five and seven years right now. So I have been part of, like, my experience of digital health and more digitally oriented healthcare delivery, in line with what Sarah just says, actually sort of like starts where, you know, Sarah, you just mentioned where it probably became more turbulent from your point of view. Because I mean, I remember the days, you know, where I grew up in Germany, where people were mostly relying on fax machines between GP surgeries and sending things back and forward. So funnily enough, when I sort of came came to this not as a patient, but as an innovator and entrepreneur from the other end of the spectrum, I was thrown into the deep end of all of the questions which are being thrown around over the last few years, ranging from interoperability over to deployment speed and things which Sarah and companies in the Digital Health Accelerator, I'm sure, encounter on a daily basis these days, because obviously the topic which always we come back to when it comes to a digital health application that is being deployed within an NHS environment is, you know, how does it read in, how does it read out and write into the electronic medical record, and how does all of that work? And there's obviously a massive compliance piece around that. What we have done is interesting, because as we are working coming out of a, you know, more molecular diagnostics and diagnostics angle into the entire digital topic, we had an opportunity there, which is on the first on the first hand, based on having a very focused clinical pathway in which we deliver, which is early cancer detection of esophageal cancer, directly looking at reflux and heartburn patients, finding these patients early, offering them an intervention where there's currently nothing in the standard of care. And then if these patients are being diagnosed, then they can be referred into more escalated pathways, and anything that has been found can be addressed downstream. But from a digital perspective, and I'm sure some of the people from our tech team actually might listen to this call, we always had this very interesting...
I hope so. I assume that you said it around the whole company.
Yes.
So what? Like the bosses on the radio?
It's blasted, all over our Slack. I think the question here was for us, how much do we vertically integrate and how much do we abstract the digital interface away from what we actually do? Because how we deliver diagnostic testing in the UK now is we try to own as much of the value chain as possible, that then the amount of integrations we actually have to do with healthcare providers is limited to a contract in most cases. So there's not much they need to do beyond that. We're also working on some new applications which are dropped right into that ecosystem, which we have been building already, which is very oriented on the specific clinical pathway we're addressing. That obviously comes at the expense of not being able to generalize, you know, across other cancer pathways and helping to triage, let's say, even a colonoscopy, you know, sort of like waiting list or something like that. But it's very specifically tailored for what we're doing in upper GI cancer.
But with them,
Yeah.
I was going to jump in. No, you carry
no,
on.
No, it's totally fine. In our case, it always comes back to, and I don't want to open that can of worms at this point in time. We have another 50 minutes to do that. Is we could probably spend
a few days. What are you going to say? I'm worried. What are you going to say?
Debating the definition of digital health and how digital has something to be in order to classify this digital health. Does it need to be, you know, some kind of application that's surfaced within a healthcare environment and is used by a healthcare professional and, you know, either makes more medicine or makes it more personalized, you know, care delivery, or increases quality, reduces cost, access, efficiency, optimization, which in our case, all of these things do, but we don't, you know, we don't provide a tool to a clinician which they log in and they then, you know, go through a list of patients and there's a smart flag being shown up on which of these patients they have to give further attention to. Obviously, this is all, you know, a massive spectrum on what we classify as digital health. But one of the ways how we try to address this, particularly in the upper GI cancer space with our first application, is also enabled by the funding we've raised. And we just closed another funding round before Christmas. We really doubled down on owning as much of the pathway in-house as we can. You know, we're now exploring an even more ambitious model, which is where we even staff the clinics in which patients that are being referred into our service are being looked after. So taking vertical integration to the absolute extreme and sort of combining the different elements, which obviously we've seen across the care delivery landscape over the last 3 years, and trying to figure out how we can make them the best use of them in one particular patient pathway, and then obviously extrapolate into others in the future.
That's extremely exciting. So are you kind of trying to move as far as you can up and downstream of the actual diagnostic piece? And why is that? Yeah. Why are you doing that?
Several different reasons. One of the main ones is probably around, and this is related to the big COVID topic, obviously, a few years ago. And I think it probably has been a topic before that. And I'm sure, Sarah, you would concur with that. Capacity resourcing has always been a challenge in the NHS. It will always be a challenge in the NHS because I think it's a healthcare system that is built to pay a lot of attention to that and optimize on that front. So we came to realize that, how do we maximize network effects and actually enable someone to start? And Sarah, you brought a great example here of people being able to deploy something within a weekend, on a system-wide basis. Obviously, what we do is in some ways a bit more hands-on, but we're trying to strive for similar types of operating models where we can basically say, okay, if you want to start with, your patients being tested next week, what do we need to do this? And I can tell you that the contrast would be in the model we're currently looking at and building. We could do that easily next week. If Sarah is a GP and wants to start next week, we could easily do that. And there would be someone in the GP surgery in the next few days, and they would set all of the relevant things up. Whereas if we would go through the more organic route, which we have in secondary care in particular over the last 2 years, just to get off the ground, things can take weeks, months. I mean, we speak about 3, 4 months, and the more we are vertically integrated, the more we own the entire delivery pathway, the less adoption challenges we have, and the easier it is to access scale.
Right. Sarah.
I certainly, where I've seen successes have been where companies and founders have really worked with the system, because you're absolutely right, Marcel. There are so many stresses within the system, and I think that in the near future, that's only going to get harder. And so therefore, any company that actually can go in and work within that system and support right the way from business cases right the way through, I think stands much more chance of actually getting accepted, getting onboarded, and working robustly within the pathway that is going
Yeah,
on. So yeah.
I completely agree, and that's what we've seen at PopDoc as well, which is it's kind of interesting because completely different areas, but Cited began with a particular hard piece of hardware, right? The Cited sponge, or sort of that was one of the key things. But in a similar way to PopDoc, we were a lateral flow that provides a 6-marker lipid panel. Those two things in of themselves are going to go absolutely nowhere without, without, well, first of all, you can't even make the diagnosis without the image analysis pathway for PopDoc, but the same, just having that kind of, that's kind of why I'm interested, and we can get into it probably after the commercial break, I guess. But that journey from, because again, particularly from the Digital Health London accelerator, which I believe applications are now open, or have they shut now, or what's the situation?
They
Are they
will be
already at?
open very soon.
Very soon.
Very
Okay,
soon. Dot,
very
dot,
soon.
dot.
Well, glad we got that out there. The is around this, just having an idea around what a physical piece of hardware can do is 1,000 miles away from that being even adopted in a pilot, let alone the ability to scale up. And so, in the same way as Cited is moving up and down the pathway, it's the same for us. And so, a lot of the NHS contracts that we've got are really around how do you own as much of that cardiovascular pathway, primary prevention, secondary prevention as you can, from risk assessment through to prescription of statins or other lipid lowering therapies. And it really is, I agree with you, Sarah, it really does seem that that is what you need to be doing and how you need to be thinking if you think the NHS is your customer or a possible customer. Is that, would you concur?
Totally agree. Totally agree. As it was always said in the NHS Digital Academy that I did, people before technology.
Right. And problem, right? For a specific problem. And also, like, probably not just, and the thing that I learned on the accelerator, which I would recommend to anyone running a health tech business who's interested in collaborating with the NHS, I can assure you that there's a lot you don't know. However much you know, there's a lot you don't know. And so I would thoroughly recommend it. And I think the thing that was really clear to me and to us when we were growing PopDoc was around the so what factor. It's like, cool, you can generate some data. That's cool. No one's been able to do that before. That's kind of cool, right? In the same way we cited, it's like it takes a gajillion years to have an endoscopy and it's quite invasive. So you've got a cool little neat thing here. That's kind of cool. But that's not the same as having a solution that the NHS can actually buy, use, scale, integrate with. You know what I mean? And even just having a clinician interested is not the same thing either, right?
No, you need to there are so many things, as you say, that we might unpick on the next part, because there it is about how we really get understanding as to what actually the product is, but also then where it fits in. Definitely.
Yeah, and I think the thing for us as well, I don't know if it's the same way for you, Marcel, it might not be, because the need that you focus on is so clear and the baseline was so low in effect, but the problem and how the system, the NHS views the problem, changes longitudinally, right? Because it's not always the same. Like if I think about, I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I think it's in some ways it's more difficult to innovate in a space. I mean, so there could be pushback on that now, but it's slightly more difficult in some areas to innovate in a space with a lower baseline, particularly in a socialized healthcare system like in the NHS, because you know, if we look at how decision making is being done from a service management perspective, you know, across an NHS trust, the easiest thing is if there's a baseline to compare it with that's ideally reasonably close, so that the things you introduce as change are in a manageable amount of categories, basically.
Right.
If you want to turn the entire hospital upside down, even though if it makes a lot of sense and it saves a lot of money, you resist. You're met with resistance, which Sarah already alluded to, which is people. It's not subject matter or business cases or anything like that. They're just a means to an end.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things which we have encountered over the last 2 years where you realize, oh, people hang on to this because the people who manage a particular area, you know, of work within a hospital, they also have to, they justify what they do, but they also need to, in some ways, justify their own business case of why they exist in the first place. So their attraction towards change might be slightly more limited, you know, by the excitement of the business case and by how much money it could actually save, because there's other motives which have to be managed in parallel. They can be managed, but it then comes back to, you know, what's the motivations, interests, and where do these people sit in the decision landscape?
I completely agree. And I know Marcel knows this. I don't know if Sarah does, but, you know, my background was in sales commercial. You know, like I love talking about that type of thing. And the number of times, not just, you know, not just now, but throughout my whole career, where people, they think they're selling to the system, then you're actually not. You're selling to an individual or a group of individuals. And like, you know, they're your customers. Yes, you know, whatever the broader organization ultimately is. But if you don't understand what they need, but what also they're scared of and what they won't do and what is a disincentive for them to agree to. And the number of times that we heard, or I heard when we were starting the company, oh, you should talk to the NHS. You think, okay, great. I'll just go talk to the NHS then. Seems like a great idea. Thank you for that kernel. So yeah, right. We're going to be right back after this commercial break, because my producer's making very concerned faces at me that we need to go to a commercial break. After that, I want to get into this life cycle of the company, right? From both an accelerator perspective, why does the NHS need accelerators? You know, I'm not trying to be annoying. I think it's an interesting question to ask. And then as an entrepreneur, you know, that journey from, okay, you've got a Cytos sponge, but that's like a long way away from where you are now, and how that journey happens, I think will be super interesting. So we'll be back in 2 minutes with Dr. Marcel Dehrung, CEO and founder of Cited, and Sarah Nelson, who's the Program Director of Digital Health London, the NHS's premier digital accelerator. We'll be right back in 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guests, Marcel Dehrung, the CEO and founder of Cited, and Sarah Nelson, who's the program director for the Digital Health London Accelerator. So, Sarah, I want to start with you. So give us just a bit of an overview, because there's probably a lot of people listening that are like, what on earth is an accelerator? Is it that thing that I press in a car? Like, what is that? Is it relevant? Like, why does the system need that? So I think maybe just a quick bit on that would be super interesting. And then if you could kind of parlay, because there's been some amazing companies that have been through the program, not just PocDoc, there are others. I think it'd be interesting to talk about that and why and how you support entrepreneurs on that journey.
Absolutely, Steve. As for why an accelerator, I suppose I can take my own experience as a senior nurse for digital working in one of the leading teaching hospitals. I had an awful lot of technology that was coming to me on a daily basis and saying, we're fabulous, we're going to solve all of your problems. And so that opportunity to have an understanding as to what is good out there, what is really going to make a difference, and what should we be putting our money to. So where an accelerator is really helpful for the system is in order to really do that due diligence on companies and review the innovations that are out there. And certainly digitalhealth.london supports some of the best and highest potential innovations that can support and transform the NHS. And they do that by putting them through quite a robust application process and review process, where they're seen by about 14, or their applications and their interviews are about 14 different NHS members of staff they come across before they even get through the door. From an innovator's perspective, they get an opportunity to spend, in our case, a year working with NHS staff who have got an interest in digital technology and bringing that into the NHS. And those innovators spend a year looking at their offering, as is at the moment, working with stakeholders and developing where things might change. They have the opportunity to really look at their communication strategy and how they can communicate to those different stakeholders. They get the opportunity to meet people from within the system. They get the opportunity to look at the evidence they have currently, and that's real world evidence as well as sort of higher levels of evidence, and look at actually in the scheme of things, how does that evidence actually stack up? And where do they need to develop the evidence? What can they actually do in their company to prove the robustness of the individual technology? So there is a system benefit to having an accelerator, and there is having for an innovator, it gives them that real structured program of development. I think it's obviously that's from my side of things too.
Yeah, I know you're going to sell it, right?
You
yeah.
From your side of things, because you were part of the program.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the and then I'll give a quick answer, and then I want to get Marcel to kind of get his view on things, because I know that he's interacted with the NHS on another accelerator. I think that the reason why we wanted to get on it was the pedigree of the program is extremely good. There's a lot of major companies that are scaling or have scaled within the NHS that have been through that program. I think also we were modest and humble enough to know what we didn't know at the time. You know, and I think the biggest mistake that companies make with the NHS is to think that it is the NHS. You know, like that, and you don't. I've always been a big believer in you really need to understand your customers if you want to actually have a good chance of success. And so just sort of willy-nilly having a crack at the NHS wasn't on our plan. So we wanted to learn as much as possible and learn what we didn't know. And that was, I mean, the program delivered in spades. On that front, you know, the access that you get to clinicians. And like I said, it's sort of, you know, having a product is, I mean, we can't do anything without a product, but it's still not the same as actually having a shot, a good chance at operating successfully in the NHS. So, Marcel, what's your view?
Yeah, so as you correctly said, we went through the other accelerator,
the other one,
the NHS Innovation Accelerator.
Yeah.
Shout out to that team. Obviously.
Yeah. It's good too. They're
underrepresented
great
on the call.
Was it Conrad there when you did it?
No. It was the team around. Actually, we were the cohort right during the transition phase. So Conrad is obviously now,
yes.
And we're still fellows in the second year, and someone else from the team is now on there. But yeah, Conrad is certainly obviously the person who looks after it now, and from what I've heard, is doing a great job at doing that. And you know, reinvigorating the entire community around it and the visibility of the accelerator. Yeah. I think what happened with us is that, and this was acknowledged at the time we joined the accelerator, we were probably too on the very mature side for the accelerator. We already had two large national programs running at the time with NHS England and the NHS Cancer Program. That was already on rails at the time. So I think if we would have been a year earlier, that would have probably been, maximum benefit. A lot of the lessons, you could take away from accelerator scheme. We already went through. We raised a 10 million seed round in the beginning, and then raised another round last year. So none of those elements were directly really applied to us, just because we, by the sheer force of the initial capital we've raised, catapulted ourselves out of the accelerator territory pretty much on day one. Also, then how quickly the organization grew, how much competence we hired into the organization, now being around 70 people or so, there's really limited things which we could really sort of like do a deep dive in. We got a lot of interesting introductions out of it, and we got a very interesting view into certain pockets of the NHS when it comes to specific types of innovations and what to be aware of in terms of bottlenecks, but also opportunities. That being said, a lot of the other profiles of individuals which have gone into the NIA, and also some of them even have gone through the Digital Health London one and through the NIA,
Yes.
MyHealth, I think, for example.
We call them
Exactly.
double winners.
Yes, exactly. Double graduates, basically. I think there's merit. I think it's important, and Sarah did that already very, very clearly and precisely for the Digital Health London one. Like, every accelerator covers a certain spectrum and is very good at a certain spectrum. There's people out there that go to accelerators because they think they're going to be accelerated by that accelerator. Well, they're only going to be accelerated in specific areas where that accelerator actually has a core competency to help. There's another one here in Cambridge, for example, Start Codon, that is run by a very dear friend of mine, who they also invest in companies, and they are now doing a lot of venture building as a venture studio. It's called Start Codon. And again, like, they have access to capital. That's one of their strengths. But you won't get the same, you won't get the same substance in some of the niches in there, which you, for example, would get at the Digital Health London accelerators. They might even be complementary, or they are even complementary in that way. But what I certainly realized is also my first experience, going into an accelerator, which was the NIA, was it's really difficult sometimes from the outside, even with the best educational material that you can make available, what you can expect from it, because there's a lot of internal challenges which people come into with an accelerator, and then there's a lot of external challenges, which is usually what the accelerator is built to solve. But then people come into it and they think they walk out of it a, three times better CEO or something like that, or three times better, three times more commercial, or three times more strategic. But it completely comes down to what people seek in accelerators, and then how they can align what they want to get out of that with the core competence of the accelerator scheme.
I agree. Like, there's no magic bullet, and particularly not if something's geared around the NHS, right? Like, no one can guarantee you success. You have to really work at it. I think, just to go back, Jason and Daniel, who run Start Codon, very close to those guys as well, love that program. So that's kind of an interesting one, just to kind of go off slightly. But
Could I
yeah,
just one thing?
go on, Sarah.
Sorry, Steve. Just to completely agree about the fact to find the right accelerator for you, but also or for your business, but also at the right time, because there may be times when it's to do with investment, and there may be times when it's to do with learning and development of the thing. So totally find it at the right time. The other thing is expect the fact that your benefits will come in years two and three after the program. They won't come during that time because you have a limited time, but that's when you build your relationships, and that goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning.
I think, totally agree. And I think things like Start Codon are kind of interesting because they're in this like venture building space, almost like you said, where it's sort of, it is an accelerator, it is a program, but they also invest. I mean, like, that's like legit. They put like 200K into each company, I think, or like 250 or whatever it is. I mean, that's like, if you're starting out and it's a spin out from one of the universities or whatever it is, like 200, 250K is pretty solid money, right, at that point in time. So credit to them for that. So Marcel, how is it, what do you have this type of stuff in Germany, or the system's different, it just works differently?
No, you do have that too. You do have that
Okay.
too. Probably even like Germany is not so clustered around London. like we are here in the UK, where obviously it feels like, all rail lines and everything start and end in London one way or the other, which also means that a lot of talent and a lot of competence and skill is in and around London and, the Golden Triangle with Cambridge and Oxford. In Germany, you have them more localized. There's sort of like technology clusters in every federal state, and every one of these capitals probably has one or the other accelerator scheme. That being said, there are a few very nationally visible ones, particularly in the tech world. They're less prominent ones, in healthcare. They're more localized. It's like, and then they're backed by, let's say, Roche, because, Roche is headquartered around the corner. Yeah, or Bayer, or BASF, or those types of companies, which again comes with a very different, comes with a very different benefit, maybe also a few more disadvantages in this case. It's certainly something which, as fragmented as the NHS might be, the entire cohesion culture around the NHS certainly enables you to build platforms like Digital Health London, where at least everyone shares the same foundation and platform they stand on. How they solve their own problems on that platform is a different question, but even though Germany is a harmonized healthcare system too, well, again, not as harmonized as the NHS is, and people would agree that the NHS is very harmonized, but relatively spoken, yes, certainly.
I think some good news about accelerators, and you're absolutely right, Marcel, that they are actually around everywhere. I mean, I have regular meetings with Estonia, with Spain,
Oh, Estonia are
Australia,
like
and Germany.
smashing it, right?
So there
Estonia
were
have got some
some
great stuff going on.
amazing things. And I think what's happening within the accelerators are we're getting better at working with each other to identify where there may be themes that are happening within the mental health is going to be a global issue. So we need to think about that. But also on a day-to-day basis, from the point of view of when you're putting out calls for international companies, actually, if we can share some of our companies, I think that's a really helpful thing. So I think there is definitely some interesting work that is going to be happening more now that each of the countries has got these hubs, if you like.
Do you see, do you, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but do you see what, or do you have an opinion about what's going to happen in the regulatory environment with CA, CE, acceptance of one, acceptance of the other, mutual? I don't know. Any thoughts? I've got some, but why don't you guys go first?
So I think this is the perfect political platform to say that the MHRA should be supported more and should receive more funding, because some people that rely on the MHRA, and I have a couple of horror stories, also from one of our most recent investors that joined Cited and some of their portfolio companies, people basically being delayed to market by, many, many months up to a low number of years, because, through various for various reasons, which most of them are political, unfortunately, UKCA and the process and how that is being managed and
Which
implemented and maintained has made things very difficult for innovators,
with
particularly in the early stage of companies.
Without breaking confidences, what type of industry were those companies in, or what kind of was there? What type of were they doing something?
High risk medical devices. So class 2B, 3.
So like diagnostic devices where there was a lot of risk around getting it wrong, in
Even
effect.
further, like also partially therapeutic. So,
And was that because there wasn't, were they effectively de novo? They were new, and so it was a bit of confusion around it, or was it like, okay.
yeah, and it was even just for them to get their clinical validations and their first clinical proof of concepts up and running, and getting study notification over to the MHRA and getting them to engage with that. It lands on a massive backlog right now. And
Yeah.
all
Well,
notified bodies in the UK are overwhelmed. We obviously, very pertinent actually to talk about this morning. The MDR transition period has been extended again.
Oh, has it? It went
Yeah,
out
it has
again, did
been.
it?
Yeah, has been
Wow.
decided this morning and communicated. So, yeah,
So
I don't even know where to start and stop here.
just to bring everyone who's listening up to speed on what's probably quite a complicated area. So probably people remember from like COVID and all the new COVID tests that are coming out, like do they have the CA mark or CE mark? It's on the bottom of everyone's kettle or whatever it is. Because we did Brexit, we transitioned over. Now we have our own thing called a CA mark. But there needs to be someone that gives you that CA mark in effect, which is called a notified body. It's just what they're called. You apply, they take a look, they ask you questions, they like it, they don't like it, they review it. But at the moment, because a large number of the notified bodies in Europe were outside the UK, none of them are allowed to give a CA mark. I think still no one's been actually approved, I don't think. So there were only ever one or two of these notified bodies in the UK, but now those two are the only ones that can effectively green light or stamp products to come onto the market in the UK, which just creates a huge backlog. Meantime, you've got, I think, 30 across Europe in some way, shape or form, 30 or 40, and they're not allowed right now to give anyone market approval for the UK, right?
Along those lines, yeah.
Roughly,
I don't know the
yeah.
exact numbers, but yeah. The orders of magnitude you're talking about sound absolutely correct. And they feel certainly that way.
And like, Sarah, on the accelerator and stuff like that, I know it's very geared around the NHS and adoption and things like that, but is regulation and regulatory, is that something where you guys have a bit of a specialism and you take companies through? I know that you kind of did with us, but I don't know whether we left before all of this like CA mark shenanigans kind of kicked off, which is really a problem for people in the industry.
I think you're absolutely right. It's having a huge impact in the industry. And I think that it is constantly changing at the moment. And
right.
There is no, we can't do an hour study session and say this is how it is, because that's not the way it is at the moment. And I think that's why being linked into anybody who actually has either a link to the regulation boards or to NHS England or any of those sort of things, if you can find somebody who can support you through this, some other bodies that can support you, because at the moment it is so unstable. And we just don't have the details to hand. So find something.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. So like in Switzerland, for example, they just announced, and by the way, everyone listening, I know they're going to be like, oh my God, they started talking about regulatory and they wouldn't stop talking about regulatory. The reason why this actually matters is that you can't do anything. You can't release a product without this. So everyone's like, oh, why can't they have more products that solve my problem? It's like, well, they need to do this. So in Switzerland, they've now said that they'll also accept anything that's FDA approved. So I'm just kind of curious to see whether...
For which there are rumors, without spilling any beans here, for which there are rumors that we're looking at a similar framework here in the UK. And
I think they have to, because you can't get the throughput with the existing agencies in the UK. So the number of products on the UK market will drop dramatically.
And we know that the FDA in not in all areas but in most areas applies a lot more rigor, and has a much higher bar. So what Switzerland has been doing or is doing right now is a very smart move, because the FDA is well funded and you know they have their own challenges, but it's you know I mean there's certain geopolitical reasons why you might not want to do something like this. And I think that plays a major role here in the UK too, is why would you want to rely on a regulatory authority from another country and you then subject yourself to other challenges. But something like that, I mean, if we would build the system from scratch, you would want to have something that is more or less globally recognized. But I don't think we're going to get there anytime soon.
Well, I don't think it's going to be soon. I do think they're going to have to figure out something, because at some point I think there's going to be a massive crunch issue, because you can't keep extending that deadline and, you know, infinitely. But anyway, we're going to go for our final commercial break and then we'll be back for the final part of the show with Sarah Nelson, head of the Digital Health London Accelerator, and Marcel Gerung, CEO of Cited. When we come back, Marcel, I want to kick off by really trying to kind of talk about the journey that you guys have been on, from a kind of an idea, a problem, a product, and now just really, because I think it's a super interesting area, is obviously not a million miles, it's a different disease area, but a similar sort of digital diagnostic at its core. And I think that that's really interesting to talk about. So let's start there and then we can wrap up the show afterwards. So we'll be back in 2 minutes, okay?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Good, Hello, welcome back to the final part of today's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guests, Marcel and Sarah. So, Marcel, you know, in as much detail as you want to go into, let's talk about esophageal cancer and how, I guess, to begin with, how did you end up focusing on that particular area or that particular condition? Just like, why? I mean, it's obviously important. I mean, I'm not saying it isn't, but, you know, there's lots of other things.
There's lots of other things. That's correct. Yeah. I mean, I think all of the listeners are certainly aware of colon cancer, bowel cancer screening programs, which have been around in, you know, many, many, many countries in the Western world for, you know, good number of years now. Lots of success at a population level, you know, great improvement in health outcomes and reduction of long-term mortality of bowel cancer and colon cancer, called colon cancer sometimes. It's funny because the lower GI tract has received a lot of attention, mostly because of the prevalence and incidence of the cancer, not necessarily because of the mortality of the cancer at the time. That also plays into the same equation because of the prevalence and the incidence. But in the upper GI tract, esophageal cancer, interestingly, belongs to one of the probably ones with medium levels of incidence and prevalence, but the second one with the highest mortality of all cancers out there. So, you know, 5-year survivals, less than 15%. It's probably 2/3 as many diagnoses of esophageal cancer compared to colon cancer every year, or maybe a bit less, actually. Maybe get my numbers wrong right now.
But it's just diagnosed a lot later, is it?
Therefore, it's just diagnosed a lot later. So the mortality rate is immense. So if you look at the absolute numbers of cancer-related deaths, then it certainly plays along many of the others up there again. If you just look at the incidence and prevalence, it doesn't play, you know, in the top X list. And because of the awareness of cancers in the GI tract, a lot of the attention has been stolen in the last 20 years by the lower GI tract and by colon cancer screening, FIT testing, you know, colonoscopy screening, and so on. And then, you know, when some more science actually was published in the late 90s, 2000s on where esophageal cancer comes from, and that it has a strong correlation or relationship with a precursor condition called Barrett's esophagus, people slowly started to develop a consciousness. And as you can imagine, this took quite a long time because we're talking about the clinical landscape and public awareness at the same time, to link original symptoms of that precancerous condition all the way to being at an increased risk of developing advanced esophageal cancer. And those symptoms are heartburn and reflux. Very simple.
Right.
Actually, in the US now, in the guidelines, that net is even cast much wider. You don't even have to have reflux anymore. You just need to be obese over 50 and male, for example. There's 3 out of 6 criteria you need to tick to be in that risk group. And when I first came in touch with it, I did not know much about Barrett's, neither did I know about esophageal cancer, until I started, you know, working with more GI clinicians, and you sort of get a bit of an understanding of what's going to be the tone in this space in 5 to 10 to 15 years, because as an innovator on these timelines, you obviously have to take odd bets. You know, there might be signals, you know, where there's increase of awareness or increase in technology traction, and then you know, a bit of a gamble and a bet to go into that space and see what's going to come out of it. And when I started working with the team with whom I ended up founding Cited together, the clinical need became very, very obvious quite quickly. There's obviously an interesting point in there, and you said it already earlier, Steve. If you just have a device, which in our case is a capsule sponge technology, so it's a small sponge inside a capsule, patients can swallow that, goes into the stomach, capsule dissolves, a small piece of sponge expands, and you can then withdraw that. Sounds uncomfortable, is actually not bad, and much more comfortable than getting an endoscopy, in case, you know, any one of the listeners ever has gone through one. That's certainly a lot more unpleasant. But, you know, what are you going to do with this? You're going to give this to a GP or to a GI clinician, and they're going to collect some cells, and then so what? What's going to happen with that? So the entire, you know, combination of what biomarkers are relevant at a very early precancerous stage, together with the device, together with understanding where in the pathway it needs to be delivered, was something that was, you know, between 2018, 2020, there was a lot of work going on, which was more in the academic setting, for us to understand that. Then we decided to build form a company around it. COVID started, and within a matter of months, we were asked to roll this out into a national program, demonstrating that, okay, if there's pressure on, in this case, it was elective services like endoscopy, and there are triaging tools or adjunct testing tools available, then suddenly, you know, the clinical pathway can leap by 5 to 7 years, over usually going through, you know, very trickled adoption over a number of years, which wasn't the case for us, but very much accelerated by COVID, because otherwise we wouldn't be in the situation we are in right now. We would probably be running, you know, some larger commercial pilots now in the UK, but we wouldn't be in pretty much 80 sites, you know, and
right,
covering the entire UK. So yeah, I skipped a few steps here because, you know, there's a lot of considerations. There's a lot of considerations that went into the, you know, why does it fit in the pathway, where it sits right now, how are clinicians dealing with the information they're getting back from a test, which is a new intervention in a pathway where there's currently no intervention, playing to my point earlier on, you know, if there's no baseline, how do you work with clinicians that have never come across something and that tells them that they should do something different or maybe the same, but again, it's something else that tells them whether they should do it. It's not their own experience or their own interpretation of guidelines. There's a lot of color in those grayed out areas, which I just outlined, and it's on the back end. We have developed a lot of digital tech tools, you know, to support and aid the delivery of it, and there's much more coming later this year and next year. But we had this curse and blessing of vertical integration. Earlier, I talked about it as, you know, as if it's the solution to everything. It makes it very difficult to build companies because, as you both, or as everyone can imagine, that probably listens to this, is having a company focus on one thing is already difficult. Now let it do four things, and all of these four things have to be done really well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are running our own labs. We have acquired a lab company 2 years ago. We do our own software development. We do medical device development. We do, you know, everything across that spectrum, which is a painful amount of horizontality and verticality to have under one.
I completely agree. And, you know, we're doing something very similar, and it's sort of, in one way, it's frustrating because you have to, in effect, you know what I mean? There isn't really a choice. Well, there is, right? Well, I mean, you could do direct to consumer and then it doesn't matter, in effect, right? But then there's just a limited, look, we work with the NHS because we want to work with the NHS and we want to help, and we know that that's the best thing to do for everybody, for the system, for patients, and for us, obviously. But the kind of table stakes, if you like, to play are a lot higher. You know, a lot more cost and a lot more overhead. But ultimately, if you can get it done, like you said, you know, you go from 0 sites to 80 sites in a couple of years, right? And that's kind of what the accelerator is all about supporting with, is it not, Sarah?
It is. And it's the understanding of the why. It's lovely hearing Marcel talk about sort of how he developed this whole company and how, where it's gone from and to. Because actually the individuals within the NHS, there is that, okay, why is this company coming towards me? Why are they telling me something? You mentioned, Marcel, about the gastroenterologist. The gastroenterologist who's been doing something exactly the same way for the whole career, to understand and to feel comfortable with something different, they've really got to understand why and where is it you come from? Why? What is it that you know that is going to change how I am? So it's fascinating to sort of see how companies have developed and why they've developed.
Yeah, and I think like the other thing, you know, a bit like we popped up with cardiovascular disease, you guys with cancer, and there are obviously a ton more. There are national level programs and funding, right, which is, I think, helpful, because it means that there's some group of people somewhere centrally that's made a decision about the need to do this, and they've done their analysis, they've done all of their clinical work, they've worked out that they need to solve this particular problem, which is helpful for innovators because it makes it easier for us to integrate and interact with that group versus a more bottom-up approach, which is having you still have to speak to clinicians, don't get me wrong, but trying to sort of, I don't know, even at a local level, bidding on a small tender for something, you know, it just makes it much easier where there's these central things. But Marcel, I don't know if you agree.
One thing which just came to my mind is that it is a lot easier to get a clinician's, you know, implicit support in saying that they think what you do is great and they support it. And it's a very different game if suddenly they have a patient coming through the door and they have to make the decision between option A and option B, and you are providing option B, and option B is new and maybe even has some clinical evidence associated to it, and them to actually make the decision. There, I mean,
yeah,
it's a big fundamental difference.
And we can't underestimate the impact of the priorities from the political priorities that there are, because it definitely impacts on the ability for innovators to be able to. I think it's quite interesting at the moment that with the large electronic health records that are being put throughout the countries, there are certain organizations that actually it's probably not a good idea to go near at the moment, because they are so they're all of their time and their headspace is all based on the electronic health record. So knowing where to actually place yourself at that point, because of the political impact. So where it can be really helpful, as you say, if nationally we're saying money for this particular area, but also the adverse side of that.
Cool. So we've got to wrap up the show. It was great to have you both on. Before we do, Sarah, if anyone's listening and they want to find out more about the Digital Accelerator, where do they go?
Okay, if they go onto digitalhealth.london's website, and so that's digitalhealth.london's website, there are all of the information about all of our programs. So that's the Accelerator program, which is a year, and then there are smaller programs associated as well. That's us.
Perfect. And Marcel, it's cited.ai, right? CYTED.ai, is that correct?
Correct, Steve.
100%. There we go. I even had that on my pad. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining, Sarah and Marcel. It was a really great show. Thank you to everyone for listening, and we'll be back again next week. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.